You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Daily Vet Life podcast, where we chat with equine veterinarians about the cases they've worked on in their clinics. I'm your host, Alex Beckstedt, editorial director of Equimanagement, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Emily Berryhill about respiratory disease in donkeys. This episode of the Daily Vet Life podcast is brought to you by DECRA. Dr. Emily Berryhill is an associate clinical professor of equine internal medicine at the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. She earned her DVM at UC Davis, where she also completed a large animal internal medicine residency. Dr. Berryhill's research focuses on equine oncology and endocrinology, with a special interest in providing veterinary care to donkeys. She loves all equids, but her number one equine love will always be the cow horse. Thanks, Dr. Berryhill, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege.
Well, we don't usually get any cases about donkeys, so I'm really excited to hear what you'll be sharing with us today. Why don't you just go ahead and tell us about this case and how the patient or patients first presented to you and your team?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, donkeys are kind of the underdogs of the equid world, but I think we are seeing more and more of them as veterinarians. And, you know, with larger rescues kind of taking hold and TV shows coming out and the like, I think it's, you know, it's good to remember that they're out there and that their needs are different to a lot of our horses. So that's why I wanted to talk about this guy today.
Yeah.
The donkey in question is a approximately 3-year-old, so young adult Jack, who was presented to our veterinary hospital for worsening respiratory disease. Backstory for him is that he was purchased at auction in Texas along with approximately 15 other donkeys and transported out to California. So that's about a 40-hour trip or so, and arrived at the sanctuary as a group about 10 days prior to his presentation to our veterinary hospital. Also of note are other donkeys within that recently acquired group began showing signs of illness about a week or so before. So, and there were two others, including this guy's companion, who were actually referred down to the clinic 2 days earlier for varying degrees of fever and progressive dyspnea. And unfortunately, this guy's companion arrived as the sickest of the group and was euthanized 12 hours before the donkey in question was brought down. And the guy who was euthanized had progressive respiratory distress and acute onset of severe colitis with acute decline. And it was kind of very clear that he was not going to come back from his disease conditions. Mm-hmm. So this brought us to, you know, now we've got a group of donkeys. Many of them are sick. We've got anxious caretakers who don't want to have any more, you know, decline and acute demise in this group of donkeys. And also of note is that these guys had a 3-hour trip just to get to us. And so, you know, figuring out timeline of referral can be tricky for these cases, and figuring out if it's worth the stress of transport for these guys, worth the stress of being away from their friends. Do they send other friends down, you know, companions with them to keep them happier? But then we've got two donkeys or more in hospital. And if they are already that sick, you know, is the trailer ride going to put them over the edge or not? So a lot of variables at play in this particular situation. And so at any rate, this guy was referred down due to his progressive tachypnea on farm and respiratory distress. At the time of referral, his resp rates were in the 70s, and the caretakers noted kind of this bobbing motion of his head when he was breathing, indicative of, you know, just having a hard time. So given the progressive change and concern over the loss of his companions, the caretakers decided to get him to us sooner rather than waiting to see if he'd recover on his own on site. He didn't receive much as far as treatment went before referral. We had recommended starting several of these guys on albuterol and fluticasone inhalers. And so he had received a dose of each of those, but not a whole lot else before hitting the road and getting to us. So on physical exam here, he was still pretty bright. You know, donkeys are such stoic animals, it makes it really tricky. His temp, he had a low-grade fever of 101. Donkeys tend to run a little bit lower as far as temps go. So normally they're 100 or less. So 101 for them is, you know, still constitutes a fever. Heart rate was 68, so a bit tachycardic. Resp rate was 48 to 52, so not as bad as what was, you know, noted on farm, but still tachypneic. And he definitely had increased bronchovesicular sounds with an occasional crackle heard when auscultating his lungs, and increased nostril flare and abdominal press as well. Lymph nodes palpated fine. No coughing was heard. No real nasal discharge. Everything else, you know, heart sounded fine. Everything else kind of checked out okay, other than the low-grade fever, tachycardia, and tachypnea with dyspnea. This was about, I want to say, 7 o'clock at night or so. So we were able to do a decent number of things, but not everything the night of admit. Initially, he had an IV catheter placed and he was started on oxygen insufflation. We were able to get our initial blood work back. So on a CBC, he did have mild to moderate neutrophilia, so about 9,500 neutrophils and a total white cell count of almost 12,000. He also had a thrombocytosis of 430,000 platelets, which donkeys really seem to like to spit out those platelets when they are under inflammatory duress. His fibrinogen was high normal at 400 mg per deciliter. His hematocrit was fine, 33%. Total protein was not that exciting, 7.2. Chemistry panel, he had some mild electrolyte abnormalities, kind of that went along with a decrease in appetite, and mildly elevated globulins at 4.5. Nothing crazy, but for us, I would say normally we see them under 4 or so. And triglycerides, which are also so important in donkeys, were mildly elevated at 92. So nothing crazy. And for some references, you know, triglyceride of 92 would be considered normal for a donkey, but just something that we always like to keep track of since it's so easy for them to go into a hyperlipemic crisis. Mm-hmm. Other blood work we also did venous blood gas and assessed his acid-base status, which was fine. And his PCO2 was 35.9 millimeters of mercury. So if anything, he was hyperventilating a bit, but still appeared able to blow off his carbon dioxide. And his lactate was normal at 1.4. So not crazy blood work, kind of fit with the donkey in front of us. Didn't give us any more heebie-jeebies, luckily. From there, we ultrasounded him, and he did have moderate comet tails or B-lines, depending on where you're trained, present bilaterally in his lung fields and pretty diffusely. He had small multifocal areas of consolidation, but he really didn't have the widespread cranioventral, you know, hepatized lung, major consolidation that goes with significant bacterial bronchopneumonia. It was more these, you know, diffuse comet tails everywhere that are more of a concern for us for interstitial pneumonia, like a viral pneumonia and or progression to acute lung injury or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Honestly, I feel, you know, I don't love seeing wide areas of consolidation cranioventrally, but at least I kind of can usually anticipate how that disease progression is going to go. Whenever we start seeing caudodorsal comet tails or changes, you know, changes in locations other than cranioventrally, I'm kind of like, this could be okay, but this could also really not go, you know, the right direction. We're going to have to monitor these guys pretty closely. We also pulled a nasal swab to submit the next day for respiratory PCR panel. And then we kind of got him settled in for the night. So we, because of the lung changes and at least risk of secondary bronchopneumonia, we started him on broad spectrum antimicrobials. So we actually gave him amikacin and sodium ampicillin. For the donkeys, just as this is kind of a tangent, and I feel like I'm going to go off on a lot of tangents, so my apologies.
No problem.
So we found that through trial and error that our donkey population here tends to not tolerate sodium ampicillin that well. Like they tend to get kind of colitis-y with it. When this guy came in, it was during a time where unfortunately PPG was on back order. Otherwise, that would have been our treatment, you know, our beta-lactam of choice. But since that wasn't an option, K-pen, we also see terrible colitis out here with K-pen. So we opted to do sodium amp, but at a bit of a lower dose. And we were only doing it every 8 hours instead of every 6 hours to try to mitigate the colitis risk as much as we could. So he was on antibiotics. He was getting his oxygen insufflation at 15 liters per minute. He was on a Gastroguard since he, you know, was eating okay, but was stressed and you know, definitely unwell. So we wanted to protect him from gastric ulcers. And then also administered fluticasone and albuterol inhalers twice a day, nebulized him with saline twice a day. The donkeys out here also tend to be low in vitamin E and selenium. This tends to be more of a California problem, at least for the selenium This guy was recently from Texas, so there's a good chance his selenium was okay, but you know, probably vitamin E deficient just from lack of pasture access as well. So we did supplement him with some vitamin E and selenium orally. And then to target the inflammation in his lungs, because we were worried about that as much as we were worried about infectious process, we started him on dexamethasone. So he did receive a 0.05 mg per kg dose of dex SPIV one time, and then along with the fluticasone inhaler that he was receiving. Mm-hmm. So kind of got him situated overnight. He did okay. He hung in there. The next day, we got our nasal swab submitted. We also pursued some thoracic radiographs to have a more global perspective of his lungs. And he did at that time have a small to moderate volume pneumomediastinum that they appreciated. At the time, they suspected it might be iatrogenic to jugular catheter placement. It wasn't super significant, but was there. And then they did appreciate the mild caudal dorsal kind of interstitial changes in his lungs that we had appreciated on ultrasound as well.
Calling all equine veterinarians. Are you tired of feeling like you're on an island when it comes to caring for your patients? Dechra Veterinary Products is here to bridge that gap. They understand the challenges you face. That's why they offer a comprehensive line of high-quality products like Zycosan and Osphos, and empower you to offer your patients cutting-edge therapies like ProVet APC. They're not just a supplier, though. Dechra provides ongoing training and support to help you stay ahead of the curve and deliver the best possible care. Visit www.dechra-us.com to discover how Dechra can be your partner in equine health.
For that second day, we kind of continued our therapeutic plan with our antibiotics, our inhalers, our, you know, just TLC. And we did receive that day that the companion who had died was positive on PCR for asinine herpes virus 3 and also influenza virus. And because of that, we know, you know, there are some case reports out there where influenza has been implicated in pretty high morbidity and mortality outbreaks in donkeys in particular. Their body just seems to have a very vehement inflammatory response, especially in animals that are really, really naive. There's a case series out of Colorado where a lot of the young ones in this case did succumb to disease and died and or were euthanized. And because we'd already had a death in this herd, we opted to start this donkey on Tamiflu, so oseltamivir. There's a case report or a small study out in horses in 2006 where they administered Tamiflu to the drug in horses challenged with influenza and found that fever and viral shedding was reduced in the treatment groups, and also found that the bacterial counts associated with secondary streptozoobronchopneumonia were reduced in the animals that received treatment. Obviously, we know that donkeys' metabolism is very different from horses in some cases, and we do not know the PK of Tamiflu in donkeys, but because we felt like this was a higher risk case and not a huge amount of risk in starting the animal on this drug, we opted to put him on it, even though we were still waiting on his PCR results. As time passed for him, the tachypnea continued. He had respirates in the, you know, about 76 to 80 and a progressive increase in abdominal effort and nostril flare, so obvious respiratory distress. And then about 2 days into hospitalization, we started to notice some subcutaneous emphysema, like in his axillary region. So you'd go to, you know, ausculte his heart or his lungs and you're like, huh, sounds like a Rice Krispie treat down there. That really started to obscure our ability to assess him with ultrasound, because literally all you could see was subcutaneous gas. And this emphysema just continued to progress until he really looked like the Michelin man. Like you could palpate
his
top line, all down his hind legs, his neck, his head. Like he had emphysema everywhere. He just looked like the fattest little marshmallow donkey ever, but it was all air. It was really.
Oh my gosh.
It made him really sore. You know, like palpation was really sore. He didn't want to move. He couldn't breathe. He didn't want to move. Like his ears were flat. He looked terrible, honestly. Like he was a sad puppy. We received his PCR results back, and he was, in fact, positive for influenza, as well as low numbers of acinetobacter herpes virus 3 as well. And we also, during that time, you know, repeated chest radiographs because of the emphysema. And he just had a progressive diffuse bronchointerstitial pulmonary pattern. And you could see the pneumomediastinum extending now into the retroperitoneal space and just his snap, crackle, pops, like basically everywhere. Other treatments that we did for him, and interestingly, he really didn't have a high temperature during this time. His highest temps were like the low 101s, but it's mostly just, you know, this respiratory rates up into the 80s and how dull and quiet he was. We upped the amount of dexamethasone we were giving him, trying to obviously balance the needs between his apparent need for potent anti-inflammatories, while also his risk of having a secondary, you know, bacterial bronchopneumonia. He's got a viral pneumonia. So we don't want to immunosuppress him, but we also need to get on top of this inflammation that is going to kill him if we don't. And NSAIDs just were not cutting it. So he ended up, I think his highest dose of dexamethasone was like a 0.07 mg per kg dose. We stayed there for a couple of days and then decreased it. After about 3 days or so, we had him tapered off of the systemic dex, and then we're continuing his inhaled fluticasone. So he was getting, you know, some steroid, but locally rather than systemically, to hopefully mitigate the impact on his, you know, immunosuppression and the rest of his system. Somehow this guy just kept kind of eating enough through this based on his triglycerides. We were rechecking those too to make sure we didn't need to intervene more with IV fluids and nutrition, and he was holding steady. So we opted to kind of leave him alone as far as nutritional supplementation went and IV fluids went, mostly because donkeys have, it's really easy to fluid overload donkeys. You know, they're designed to be very efficient with their water consumption and how they, you know, what they do with their body water. And so the risk of fluid overloading, and especially into really leaky lungs, like he was already having, you know, degrees of pulmonary edema. So we didn't want to put him over the edge. And so as long as he was kind of taking care of himself fluid-wise and nutrition-wise, we figured that was better than anything we were going to do for him. However, on day 4, he did develop a higher temperature of 102.2. He stopped eating. His PCO2 intravenous blood gas was the highest it had been at 52.5, so millimeter mercury. So still not terrible, but a little bit higher and probably starting to reflect his severe respiratory disease, even though his resp rate actually was coming down and was in the upper 20s at this point. And maybe he had a degree of kind of intercostal muscle fatigue at this point too. You know, he'd been working really hard to breathe for several days and his body was just getting pretty tired. Mm-hmm. It would have been nice, you know, in an ideal world, we would have done arterial blood gas to really assess our ventilatory status, but we were unable to achieve this due to the emphysema everywhere.
Yeah.
We rechecked his CBC at that point too, and his neutrophil count was now a low normal at 4,000, which honestly seemed a little bit inappropriate, especially, you know, he'd been receiving steroids. He had an infection. This had been going on for a few days. So we honestly expected his neutrophils to be a bit higher. He had a mild lymphopenia, which we weren't surprised about. And then his fibrinogen at this point was now elevated at 600, which also, you know, fit with the disease process. So no surprise there. And his triglycerides were elevated at 136 at this point. So, which is still for a donkey, not crazy high by any means, but didn't love the trend going from triglycerides in the 20s to triglycerides of over 100. So at this point, we couldn't assess his lungs at all on ultrasound due to the emphysema. So we were kind of flying blind, but we were worried that he was maybe starting to develop worsening bacterial bronchopneumonia secondary to everything. And we had our, you know, our gram positives covered with the ampicillin. We had our gram negatives covered with our amikacin, but we opted to put him on metronidazole to increase our anaerobic coverage at that point and do the best, you know, the best that we could to cover bacteria that we didn't, you know, may or may not have been treating. Didn't do a transfusion wash in him because he was in such respiratory distress. It would not have been good for him. We also started him on a low rate of IV fluids, just very low maintenance with a whiff of dextrose. So he was getting like a 0.70 0.75% dextrose is added to his fluids to just boost his nutritional supplementation, and then kind of controlled his fevers with Banamine. Luckily, that seemed to be a pretty transient finding for him. And, you know, 24, 36 hours later, he no longer had a fever. His heart rate was in the low 50s, which was better for him. His respirate rate was in the 20s, still with increased respiratory effort, but it seemed to be improving. His appetite was improving. He started to pass soft worms manure at that point. We were able to wean him off his oxygen over 2 to 3 days, wean him off his IV fluids. And then change during this time was that when he developed that soft manure, we did stop the ampicillin because, you know, in hindsight, we're like, well, maybe his drop in white blood cells and the fever was actually him showing us that he was developing colitis and it wasn't related. It was a new problem and not related to his respiratory disease. And we definitely didn't want to get to a point of severe colitis. So stop the ampicillin. Kept him on the amikacin, and then we actually started him after a bit of a, 12 hours or so off. We started him on minocycline, and we selected that as it was relatively broad spectrum and also has some anti-inflammatory properties that we figure was only going to help us, wasn't going to hurt us, and hopefully would help us out a little bit more. From there, this guy, just kind of continued to improve slowly. He was ultimately hospitalized for 16 days or so, and we finally discharged him once his respiratory effort really stabilized. He was eating well. We were able to start visualizing his lungs on ultrasound a bit again. And also, for these guys, when their lungs are so fragile and damaged, the ambient temperature and environment to trailer them home in and to send them home in is really, really important. And so we opted for, we get really hot summers and falls here in California. So we waited until the ambient temperature was suitable for him to make that 3-hour journey home, and that they had set up a good place for him to, have ambient cooling, be in the shade, have reduced particulates to breathe in, all of these kind of lung supportive care plans in place to kind of give him the best shot. Ultimately, I think he went home on a tapering course of albuterol and fluticasone for about a month or so. So no more systemic steroids, but continuing the inhalers for a while, vitamin E for antioxidant support, and minocycline for 2 weeks or so. So a total of about 3 weeks or so of mino when all was said and done. And then again, whatever we could do to maximize his respiratory comfort at home, knowing that these guys tend to have a risk of recrudescence just because, we know we're not sending home a healthy donkey. We know there still is lung disease present, and the risk of having that inflammatory cascade start over in the lung was pretty high. And so we wanted to do, whatever we could to kind of keep everything at bay and give him time to heal. So that was a rapid fire summary of this guy. And he was just, we were really glad that he was able to make it home because it was looking pretty dicey there for a bit.
Seriously, yes.
And during that time, I think there are 4 others who also were referred down with varying degrees of, similar pathology, some with worse bacterial pneumonia, some with worse kind of viral or interstitial pneumonia, and varying needs. And ultimately, everybody except for that initial one was able to make it home, which we were happy about.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that little donkey really ran through the gamut of things while in your care. Wow.
He did. And donkeys, I think I was thinking through when I was thinking about this case and thinking about take homes. And I think one of them that I've learned, the donkeys are so humbling. And just when you think, you're getting good at reading them or getting good at figuring out their disease processes, and they're like, haha, try again. And what I think I've learned from these guys is how, they are so stoic and their behavior is so different that they really they make you work for it to figure out what's wrong with them, and I've had the luxury of going to ultrasound donkeys when they're newly arrived at the sanctuary, and they'll be standing there looking at you, eating, no fever, and then you scan their lungs and they have massive areas of consolidation, and you're like, if you were a horse, you would be trying to die already, and you're just standing here looking at me. but I know if I don't treat you now, we're going to get in a world of hurt, and by next week. So the importance of kind of screening these guys, especially after, when they come from kind of the auction situation with a bunch of commingling, poor health, long trailer rides, the stress of transport, all of that stuff puts them, you know, they're kind of the perfect storm for developing these infectious respiratory diseases that can then spiral into these, you know, deadly inflammatory processes.
Right. Do you have any concerns because of this donkey's such severe respiratory disease of having any, you know, lingering effects or things that you need to watch for in the future?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there's, you know, there's the Donkey Sanctuary in the UK, which is a really, they've got a really great website and are a really good resource and have done so much with donkeys for years now. They kind of see a bit of a different population. They don't really have like the auction pipeline there, and they have a lot that live kind of into old age and our owner surrenders. But they've noted in a lot of their necropsies that donkeys, there's a subset of donkeys or a large number that do have fibrosis, like pulmonary fibrosis. There is work being done to suggest that potentially this could be due to like asinine herpes virus 5, which is similar to equine, you know, to EHV5 and like a equine multinodular pulmonary fibrosis type situation. So that could be a contributing factor in some cases, but more research is needed there. As far as, you know, cases like this guy, again, we need to follow some more, you know, out longer to see if they are going to end up with fibrotic changes or not, or if you can control, if either they're either going to die during this acute disease process or they're going to get through it and then be okay. I do think they're going to be more at risk of recrudescence in that first few month period after, you know, they have had such a severe insult. And that risk of recrudescence is going to be increased if their environment is not able to be managed. So if it is, you know, 105 degrees outside, if it's super dusty, if they're eating straw out of a big feeder and just inhaling all these particles, you know, kind of those factors could put them more at risk for having another bout of disease, which could potentially be worse and then potentially lead them more towards a fibrotic state or so too.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But so far, knock on wood, everybody has recovered and seems to be doing fine. Also, you know, it's, we're not asking most of these donkeys to be performance animals too, you know.
True.
We're not making
yes.
them go run races in a lot of cases, although in Colorado and in some places you can definitely run donkey races, but, or there, you know, whatever. There are a subset of high performance donkeys, but it is not a large percentage of our population. So they can probably do a lot better living with some residual potential, you know, scar tissue in there than a horse that we're asking to jump or run or work a cow or, you know, whatever that might be.
Right. Well, do you have any, you know, last advice for practitioners that might be facing similar cases, especially considering all the physiological and metabolic differences between donkeys and horses?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to be like overzealous in my concern.
Yeah.
For the cases, I guess I always err on the side of anxious with these guys, again, just because they're challenging to monitor and challenging to, you know, to get to ahead of the game in a lot of cases. By the time you see a sick donkey, they're often really, really quite sick. So I think if you're a practitioner in an area where you are seeing these rescue donkeys coming through pipelines, I'm definitely an advocate for screening early and screening serially as best as possible. So you can try to nip things in the bud before they become life-threatening, if at all possible. The other thing, and oftentimes they will need, you know, they will need steroids in some capacity. Obviously, donkeys also are prone to metabolic disease and increased risk of laminitis in a lot of cases too. So just trying to find that balance between the use of systemic steroids and, you know, inhaled steroids. I think inhaled is always going to be preferred if you have access to them, if your sanctuary or owner can afford them, and if they're going to be, you know, enough to get the inflammatory disease process under control. But if you have an animal that's worsening in the face of that, then I've gotten braver, I guess, about using steroids, but I always obviously, you know, talk to owners about the risks, you know, potentially associated with them and try to get them off of the systemics as soon as possible. And then definitely cover them with antimicrobials during that period too, knowing that they're going to be at high risk of bacterial pneumonia if they don't have it already. And then if you add in immunosuppression on top of that, that could make things potentially worse. The other thing that I think is just interesting is that, and this is so people don't panic, is that on your PCR panel, there is So equine herpes virus 1, which is reportable and causes all those bad things that people talk about all the time, is very closely related to asinine herpes virus 3. And so if you've got a donkey, and donkeys can have EHV1, but it is more common for them to have AHV3. So if you've got a swab that is positive for EHV1, I will ask the lab to test it also for AHV3. And most of the time it's going to be AHV3, which is not reportable, can still cause severe respiratory disease, can still in very rare instances cause neurologic disease, can still has been reported to cause abortion. So it's not like, it's not a great disease to have, but at least it's not the reportable EHV1 and shouldn't cause as much panic as an EHV1 positive would, if that makes sense. But definitely talk to, I'm not a virologist, talk to, you know, Dr. Pasterla or somebody, yeah. More details as far as that goes. But that's just been a learning point for me as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I obviously didn't know that. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Berryhill, for joining us today and for sharing this case. It was super interesting and very detailed. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was a fun thing to do. I hope it wasn't like overwhelmingly detailed.
Well, thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in as well. And thank you to our sponsor, DECRA.